Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk about the case of an Iowa man who was sentenced to 10 years in prison this week for his role in the deaths of two minors while he was texting and driving. Dan McGeehee will join us talking about our epidemic of texting and driving and tragic consequences thereof. Before that, let's go to the primaries held this week in our state and seven other states, I believe, on Tuesday. Joining us now to reflect on what we know now that we didn't at the start of this week, Kay Henderson, news director for our Radio Iowa. Hi, Kay.
Good afternoon.
So let's jump right into one of the headlines, a record number of women on the ballot.
Right. The Carrie Chapman Catt Center up at Iowa State University for Women and Politics has done the analysis, concluded there will be 84 female names listed on the ballot as of today. As you may know, the political parties in Iowa may still nominate individuals to fill open slots in some of these races, so there may be even more come August when the ballot deadline is reached. The 84 women who are on the ballot this time around is a 29% increase from 2016.
Mm-hmm. And are we attributing this to the Me Too movement and to the character of our president?
I think that the Carrie Chapman Catt Center would attribute it to the groundswell among women to be more active in politics. Diane Bystrom, the director of the center, told me that if you look at some of the research that's gone on this year in these primaries, what people are seeing is that in primaries where there is no incumbent and there's a female candidate and maybe a couple of other male candidates, the female candidate just wins sort of going away, and that's what we saw in a couple of these congressional races in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just talk about the margins. That was really a bit of a surprise, right, Kay?
Exactly. I think people had a feeling based on the fundraising prowess of Abby Finkenauer and her connections in the Dubuque area, her experience running before as a state legislator, that she may have had an edge over three competitors who came from areas of that district that are population centers, Cedar Rapids and the Waterloo-Cedar Falls area. Yet she won that race going away, as did in the third congressional district. Cindy Axne, a Democrat from West Des Moines, was competing against two men. The only real public opinion poll that was conducted independently of any campaign showed sort of a tight race between Cindy Axne and Eddie Morrow in that race, but she won significantly by, again, more than she went past the 50% margin in terms of collecting votes. So what has been seen in other parts of the company was exhibited in those two races.
Mm-hmm. Talk about turnout overall.
Mm-hmm. Democrats set a record for participation in a Democratic primary. Republicans hold the overall record for primary participation for the surge election that we saw in 2010 when Republicans were reacting to the election of Barack Obama. What was interesting is that I think people heading into this we're sort of used to, I don't know if you were, but sort of these sort of nail-biter elections. You know, we had caucuses in 2016 where, you know, just a really small margin separated Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And then nationally, the sort of nail-biter in terms of other races. And so to see Fred Hubble win by such a large margin in a large field and win pretty handily, I think, was a surprise to many Democrats.
Right. And the two matching up for the November election, the governor and Fred Hubble, wasted no time attacking each other, right?
Indeed. In fact, Governor Reynolds gave a speech at Republican Party headquarters at 9 p.m. on Tuesday, just as the polls were closing, suggesting that Fred Hubble was too rich to relate to working class Iowans. She questioned whether he had ever had to balance a family checkbook. About 14 hours later, Hubble, in a question and answer session with reporters, shot back and said he had not only balanced a family checkbook, he had balanced corporate checkbooks through his business life, and he contrasted that with a record he says shows that the governor has not balanced Iowa's checkbook, if you will, state government's checkbook, in the way that he would.
Mm-hmm. What were the highlights when we go down to the state legislative primaries? There were so many of them, of course, we can't go through those. But do you have any highlights or thoughts about the primaries for state lawmakers?
Well, as was the sort of conventional wisdom heading into this, it appears that the Iowa House is where the most drama will be, if you will, heading into November. That's where Democrats may have the best chance of winning enough seats to take majority control of the House. They have recruited candidates in 95 of the 100 districts. And speaking with Democratic leaders, they expect to recruit a few more. And I think that's where the money, the investment will go into House races. And if it turns out to be a wave year, we have no idea if it will for Democrats. Their thinking is that maybe some of these marginal races, a candidate who might in any other year be at a distinct disadvantage as a Democrat in the district might end up winning. And, you know, if we go back through the record books here, sometimes these legislative races are decided by, you know, 12 votes or 22 votes. So that's could be significant. The Iowa Senate, meanwhile, is a different story. Republicans have recruited many female candidates in some key races around the state, and they're feeling fairly good about the position they hold heading into November.
Okay, Kay Henderson, we're sure glad we have your eyes and ears on the politics between now and November. Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa, where she is news director. Thanks, Kay.
Thank you for the invitation.
One of the notable primary election victories was that of Zach Walls. He's been on this program, a high-profile candidate in eastern Iowa's Senate District 37. He won that primary easily, a seat opened up by the retirement of Senator Bob Dvorsky. Let's go back to his big splash as a 19-year-old college student back in 2011. Zach Walls stood up in front of a committee of Iowa lawmakers to defend gay marriage and his experience growing up with two moms.
I'm not really so different from any of your children. My family really isn't so different from yours. After all, your family doesn't derive its sense of worth from being told by the state, you're married, congratulations. No, the sense of family comes from the commitment we make to each other, to work through the hard times so we can enjoy the good ones. It comes from the love that binds us. That's what makes a family. So what you're voting here isn't to change us. It's not to change our families, it's to change how the law views us, how the law treats us. You are voting for the first time in the history of our state to codify discrimination into our Constitution, a Constitution that, but for the proposed amendment, is the least amended Constitution in the United States of America. You are telling Iowans that some among you are second-class citizens who do not have the right to marry the person you love. So will this vote affect my family? Would it affect yours?
A bit of Zach Walls from 2011. That was the most viewed YouTube political video of 2011, ahead of President Obama's announcing the death of Osama bin Laden. Zach Walls winning that primary, District 37 in the Democratic primary. No Republican challenger in that for the fall at this point. There is a Libertarian that will be on the ballot as well. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, NewsBuzz edition. Well, if you are still in the habit of texting while driving, it's time to make a pledge to never, ever do it again. You need some convincing? Well, here's a story that should do it. This week, an Iowa man was sentenced to 10 years in prison for his role in the deaths of two minors while he was texting and driving. Let me read some excerpts from a Gazette article this week written by Trish Mahaffey. Jennifer Perez says she's gone through the motions of life on automatic. Sleep, get up, eat, lather, rinse, and repeat. Since the day in 2016, a man who was texting at the wheel, smashed into her car, and killed her two daughters. We'll never be the same. We all died that day, Perez of Marion said, while giving a victim's impact statement Monday during the sentencing of Keith Fearn. In April, a jury convicted Fearn, 35 years old, of Cedar Rapids on two counts of homicide by vehicle and one count of reckless driving resulting in serious injury. Another excerpt from that article a little bit later. Perez's daughters, Selena and Isabella, 16 years old and 13 years old, were passengers in her car November 3, 2016, when Fearn crashed his pickup truck into their stopped Chevrolet Aveo on County Home Road north of Robbins. The two teen girls died from blunt force injuries. Her other daughters, Alicia, now 16, suffered permanent injuries, and Mia, now 5, had minor injuries. Evidence at the trial showed Fearn was driving 60 miles per hour west on County Home Road just before striking the Aveo driven by Perez. She had stopped the car behind a truck that was waiting to turn left on North Troy Road. Fearn rear-ended the Aveo. His pickup continued another 670 feet before stopping. Think about that. That's the length, more than the length of two football fields. Prosecutors argued that Fearn, according to the cell phone records, was texting up to the moment of impact. His Silverado pickup was going 60 miles per hour up to a half second before the crash based on the vehicle's data retrieval. He didn't brake. Selena and Isabella died from massive blunt force injuries. The other girls in that very severely injured in that crash. Reading that rather lengthy excerpt just to make sure that we know this is not just statistics. These are real people, in this case, a real family destroyed. Dan McGehee with us, director of the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa, also professor in mechanical and industrial engineering. Dan McGehee, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ken. Great to be here.
You've been an expert witness, not in this case, but in court in a similar case here in Iowa.
Yes, about a year and a half ago, we had the first conviction in a similar case in Webster County in Dayton, Iowa, where a young man, a 19-year-old at the time, Colton Bills, killed David and Velma Castenson in a very similar scenario, except he went through a stop sign at a high speed and broadsided this couple.
Mm-hmm. The judge in this case called texting while driving a public epidemic. She hoped this sentence will send a message that the court considers texting while driving a serious offense with serious consequences. Is that what is needed to change the culture of texting while driving? We have new laws here in Iowa, not as stringent, as aggressive as some would have liked, but a step forward against those who, you know, have one cell phone in one hand and the steering wheel in the other. What are your thoughts on how to change this culture? You and I know, Dan, we can go out of this studio, get in our cars, and within minutes see someone texting and driving.
Yeah, it really is an epidemic. I mean, our smartphones, I mean, it's really not even texting anymore. It's really the use of our phone. And we saw, you know, last week, Apple and other phone makers putting software on our phones that can sort of limit that addiction. So it's Instagram, it's Facebook, it's texting. We can't really go more than a few minutes without checking our phones anymore. It is a pure addiction. Mm-hmm. To combat that, we're going to have to look at this at many different angles. And similar to smoking in restaurants, something that was very common in the past, and all of a sudden we fairly quickly changed that, where if we walk into a place where they're smoking, we're immediately assaulted. We have to get to that social norm that this is really a bad thing. Unfortunately, in driving, everybody else is the bad driver, and we are the good driver. And that's been a challenge around the world in terms of how people view driving.
Dan, you and I are old enough to remember the years-long campaign against drunk driving. If we go back to the 1970s, those who weren't around at that time will not remember, but we can say there was kind of a wink and a nod to drinking and then driving, right?
Oh, absolutely. We would be at our family reunion parties and family parties where Uncle Bob drank a six-pack and he would trundle off and take that station wagon home and nobody would even really blink.
Might even have a chuckle about it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, look at him stumbling out the door and hitting the road. Alcohol is quite different, even though we still see a really very high percentage of crashes having alcohol impairment. And now increasingly drug impairment, whether it's cannabis or other drugs, opioids on board.
Mm-hmm. Can you sort of compare those side by side with data? How much more of a menace you are when you're texting while driving compared to having a few drinks? Is there any sort of comparison that can be made there?
Yeah, there's been comparisons made between the two. I'm not a big fan of those because the difference is that alcohol is a more sustained impairment, and so you're not a good driver for the period of time that you're on the road. Texting is much more episodic. We pick up our phone and we look away from the road when we're engaged in a phone conversation. It gets very intense for those moments, many seconds. So we can look away from the road for about 1 3/4 seconds before we have to correct our lane position. Once you get past that, the average text message, a short text message, takes about 4 seconds to compose. A complicated message to read can take your eyes off the road for multiple seconds. And then you might have a check glance and then up and down. And that's where we really see the issue in terms of these crashes and so forth.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned here, this individual, Keith Fern, didn't even hit the brakes. He was going 60 miles an hour, plowed into the back of this small Chevy Avio, killing two of the passengers, severely injuring the others in this case. What is the process of reconstructing crashes to see the effect of distraction? How is that done?
So first off, the evidence that showed that he was not braking is actually pretty common in these fatal crashes, where we see very little evidence at all with the driver interacting with the brakes or the steering. But we do in any crash reconstruction is that we work backwards from the time of impact. You mentioned the event data recorder that most new cars have, where we get just a few things, whether your foot is on the brake, what the speed was, where your seat belts are on, those kinds of things in the moments, in the last 5 or 6 seconds before the airbags are deployed. Then in the case of a cell phone call, and today this is also something that's very much changed, law enforcement immediately goes for the phone in almost every fatal crash, if not every crash, to ask the question to rule it out. So when there's a suspicion that there is phone involvement, those records will be collected from the carrier. And then we can actually see what those messages are in some cases. And in the case in the Dayton, Iowa fatalities, we actually, for the trial, reconstructed what the phone looked like along a timeline. And we can get very precise because when you send a text message down to the second, there's a timestamp associated with that message. Mm-hmm. And so there's a certain rhythm to how we send messages back and forth. During a sequence, we can reconstruct those all the way up to the impact time of the crash.
And really, I like the point that you made before, is this is not just about texting. This is about the little computers that we are now so dependent on. We may be looking, we may be Googling something. I mean, distraction is distraction. It's just not not just texting. You may be looking something up on the internet.
Right, and it's really the physical manipulation of the phone and your eyes off the road. So you're both physically manipulating the device and looking away from the road. That is really the worst of distraction.
Mm-hmm. So talk about some remedies here. The tech fixes you mentioned, are they up and coming? So we've got, two dimensions here. The tech fixes, but then also the change, the social mindset that said this is not okay, what are we to do? Let's go back out on the street in our cars, Dan. You look over in the next lane, someone's texting away and giving very little attention to their driving. Will we get to the point where you take that license plate down and turn them in?
Yeah, I see there's sort of a three-legged stool approach that we see. There's certainly the education and the communication of why this is bad and what the effects are is an important component. Laws are another one that people sort of pay attention to. In this case, now we finally have a primary law, which means the police can pull you over if they see you texting. Mm-hmm. It's a $100 fine. That's really not that big of a deal. But
do we know if that's been imposed a great deal since the law came into effect?
I haven't looked at the data, but people know that it's illegal, and that in many cases is a reason. And then finally, the area that we really work a lot on is in the technology side of things, where we can sort of look over the shoulder of the driver And if we detect a vehicle that stopped or moving more slowly, we automatically can put the brakes on in these mm-hmm. cases. High speed is much more difficult when you have a stopped vehicle. But certainly the technologies that we're developing here at the University of Iowa and have now for over 20 years, along with our national and international partners that do research with us, that future technology is one leg of that stool.
You mentioned international partners. Other countries facing the same thing? Are they doing a better job at handling this new technology in combination with driving?
Well, if you take a look at Europe, tends to be much more stringent when it comes to traffic violations like speeding. You know, in Germany, as you know, traffic cameras are everywhere. They're mobile. They pop up. You have very big consequences for getting tickets. You literally will lose your license. And it's very similar when it comes to texting and phone use. People understand that side of the rule of law, and they're not willing to go there.
Mm-hmm. Is this problem getting worse? I mean, we've been talking about it since our cell phones, the first iPhone came into existence in 2007, and we can see how quickly we've ramped up into many of us into total dependency on these little devices here. What are some other trends that you see as we've adopted these in connection with driving?
Certainly our addiction continues, but I think, you know, one thing that Apple started and others are going for is the do not disturb while driving. So a phone knows when it's in motion and whether you're driving or not. That's another technology intervention that essentially is the default.
And you have to elect that, or?
It is standard. It starts that way, and then you have to sort of say, no, I'm not driving. So every time you drive, after a while, a lot of people say, okay, that's okay. I don't really need to be on the phone all the time. It sort of automatically does that, much like the security code used to be an opt-in. Now it's standard. Cell phone theft has gone down a lot because of that.
Oh, because we have to do a pattern or a code. Right, because people don't steal cell phones as much.
Right, because that's the default, and that's the key. So the default is that the do not disturb function is there from the beginning on your phone rather than having to opt in every time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very interesting. Thank you for being available, Dan McGehee, Director of the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And we'll watch these trends and hopefully see fewer tragedies out there like the one I just described. I'll bookend it by saying, if you're in the habit of texting while driving, it's time to make a pledge right now to never, ever do it again. Dan McGehee, thanks again.
Thank you.
Coming up in our second half hour, Camp Wapsie in eastern Iowa turns 100. We'll talk about that. Also, Miss Iowa from 2013 will join us. Nicole Kelly reflects on the announcement this week by the Miss America pageant that it will drop the swimsuit and evening gown competition. That's all coming up in our second half hour. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of our News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Monday on this program, Senator Charles Grassley is due to join us live. He'll talk about that summit. We'll ask him about that for sure. Also, the Russia investigation, judicial nominations Monday on the program. Senator Charles Grassley scheduled to join us live. We hope you'll join us as well. Goodbye, swimsuit competition. Hello, Miss America 2.0. That was a headline in the New York Times this week on Tuesday. The Miss America organization announced it would scrap both the swimsuit and evening gown portion of the competition. Here's some British movie tone archival footage of Miss America finalists in swimsuits and gowns parading for the 1954 competition.
Very nice scenery they have in Atlantic City this time of year. Yes, you're right. These are finalists for the title of Miss America 1954. Everyone may be a honey, but only one can really be in the money. But which figure will figure in the five-figure class? Well, that's what it amounts to in the end. A tantalizing assignment for cameramen who now have to focus on beauty fully draped in evening dress. The winner? Well, she's 19-year-old Lee Ann Merriweather from San Francisco. I understand she wins the equivalent of £17,857 in prizes.
Okay, British movie-toned archival footage we're hearing there from Miss America finalists 1954. Joining us now, Nicole Kelly, Miss Iowa 2013, current producer for the Miss Iowa competition. Nicole Kelly, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for being on with us. I was back in the 1900s there. Almost gave you a 1900 win there.
Made me a little older than I am. That's okay, though.
Give us your reaction as someone who won Miss Iowa. You did a swimsuit competition in that and then did a swimsuit competition at the Miss America pageant as well. What's your reaction to this news?
I did, yes. So I absolutely, to win Miss Iowa, did swimsuit and went on to Miss America and competed in swimsuit as well. However, I personally am so excited about the direction that Miss America is moving, because the honest truth is that once you're handed that crown, once I was crowned Miss Iowa, there was only one other day that I ever wore a swimsuit, and it was on the national stage at Miss America. The rest of my time, Miss Iowa is a full-time job. The rest of my time was traveling the state to actually talk about my platform and to share my platform in schools and at community events all over our state. So what the actual job is has nothing to do with modeling. So I think this is a really, really strong, awesome move, because it really is aligning what you do and in everyday context with what you're actually competing for and showing on stage.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, was there a consensus among contestants or you and other Miss Iowa or Miss America pageant contestants? Is there disagreement among those who participate in this, or is there a consensus, we don't like the swimsuit?
It actually has been very interesting to watch unfold. My Facebook echo chamber, as I like to call it, is full of course, pageant girls who I've met throughout the years and who I've become close with, and not only girls who have competed, but volunteers of the organization, sponsors of the organization, just the whole package of people who are really passionate about pageantry. And honestly, it has been, it's been across the board. People have very emotional but different reactions. Some people see it as a really traditional part of it, because after all, Miss America did start as a swimsuit contest. That's just history and fact. So some people see it as letting go of something that is quite traditional. Some girls really, really credit Miss America with getting into working out and really eating healthy and kind of learning to care for their body because of this phase of competition. And then there's kind of this other slot of people who are me, who think, no, let's make our way into the 21st century. Let's take out this modeling aspect if we're not trying to model, and let's be better for it. Mm-hmm. So it's been an interesting kind of rumbling across the board there.
Did you feel comfortable in your swimsuit about in front of the huge audience at the Miss America pageant, for instance?
You know, I did. I'm a very confident person. So for me, walking on stage in a swimsuit was fine. It's not as though I felt like anything was morally wrong with me doing that. Where the cognitive dissonance came in for me is, really, it was a means to an end, so I would have a larger audience to be able to share my message with. Mm-hmm. It was kind of something I had to check off the list to do in order to share my message. So I did so, but certainly think that there are other ways that you can show lifestyle and fitness if that truly is what you're trying to, quote-unquote, judge a girl on. Yeah, I think there are other ways.
And for those in our audience who don't know this, becoming Miss Iowa in 2013 had an extra layer for you. You were able to represent, and I think this is what you meant by your message, the world of disability. You were born without a hand.
Correct, yeah. So add in the fact that the day after Iowa put a crown on my head and said, all right, congratulations, you're the girl going to Miss America, I actually became world news. And I was world news because who, let's think about the girls who represent beauty in the world of this pageant, right? It's very much always the same size, it's the same shape, it's the same, you're seeing the same body over and over again. And the fact that I was somebody who had a different body, somebody who was missing a hand, somebody who did not fit into that standard box of what you saw was a very, very big deal. So I am seeing this as another push towards inviting other body types into this world, inviting other girls into this cool world where I really was honestly able to travel and speak and share my message, not only across the state of Iowa, but across the country. Mm-hmm. And I think there are other really, really passionate girls who have a message like I have, who could join us and who could win scholarship money. Miss America gifted me with, I almost completely wiped out all of my undergraduate student loans because of the money that I received from scholarship. So it really, there are all of these wonderful, amazing things that I got to do and I got to share and confidence I got to build from this program that kind of seemed to be overshadowed by this swimsuit competition.
Talking about this change, now, does Miss Iowa, you're the current producer for the Miss Iowa competition, is there still or has there been, how recently has there been a swimsuit competition or part of that competition, the Miss Iowa?
Sure. So this announcement was, of course, just made this week. And actually, we go into rehearsals for the Miss Iowa pageant this Sunday. So I'm getting ready. I'm in full swing of scripting and dancing and music and all kinds of things to get ready for that. And we will, on stage, the pageant actually will be in Davenport at the Adler Theater next weekend. If you want to catch us, we're going to crown Miss Iowa Saturday night, the 16th. And we will do swimsuit one last time. That is happening because nobody fully knows what Miss America is kind of replacing or changing it with. So it is staying the quote-unquote traditional format one last time until we actually see what that means at Miss America, what these mm-hmm. changes actually mean. And next year we will follow suit and apply those changes to at the state level as well.
So this year, you can tell us, as the current producer for the Miss Iowa competition, will be the final year of swimsuit competition at the Miss Iowa competition.
That is correct. You are absolutely right. Yep, last year.
Now, according to reports that I'm seeing, the Miss America organization will replace the swimsuit and evening gown portion of the competition with what they call a live interactive session with the judges, in which a contestant will, in the words of this release, highlight her achievements and goals in life. That's already part of the competition, isn't it? It seems to me. I don't watch these things regularly, but...
Yes, that is all the information that anybody knows. Let me start with that. Is it's kind of a big question mark as to how that actually will play out on stage. Nobody is quite sure what that means. But yes, you are correct. A huge, actually the biggest chunk of a girl's score when they compete at a Miss Iowa or at Miss America is an individual interview that they have with judges. And I can tell you that to go to Miss America, I essentially went back to summer school because in that interview room, you are being asked all the tough questions. You are being asked current event questions. You are being asked moral questions. You are being, certainly part of it is to share about your platform and about yourself and who you are. But a lot of it is to see how you feel and how you react to being asked these types of tough questions. So yes, there is a portion of competition, but I think the twist is that the audience never gets to see that. They never get to see how well a girl speaks, or they don't get to see how well that she interviews or interacts with people. So I'm interested to see how that translates into this new phase of competition. I'm not sure fully what to expect from it, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Do you think contestants, you, for example, would sweat the interview more than the nearly bygone swimsuit phase?
I think most girls would say yes to that, but my mother has gifted me with the gift of gab, so I actually loved interviewing.
Yes, we can hear that.
I'm sure you can tell, yeah. So I was never, yet again, what I would say, nervous, other than nervous, excited to walk on stage in a swimsuit, but I would have ranked myself more nervous to walk in a swimsuit than actually to interview in that room with the judges.
Nicole Kelly, Miss Iowa 2013, current producer of the Miss Iowa competition. Nicole, it's been a pleasure talking with you about the decision by Miss America organization this week to scrap both the swimsuit and evening gown portion of the Miss America pageant. Nicole Kelly, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Is your kid off to summer camp yet? Or perhaps, like me, you have adult kids who have their camp summers behind them. Well, the YMCA Camp Wapsie in eastern Iowa, that's near Coggin, marks its 100th anniversary this year. Founded in 1918, Camp Wapsie offers co-ed summer camp programs for boys and girls ages 6 to 18. They also serve campers of all ages through year-round retreats, youth and family programs, variety of activities. Really a wonderful place. Paul Danowski is with us, Executive Director of Camp Wapsie. Thank you for joining us, Paul.
Yes, good afternoon.
Well, a personal note, to get this out of the way and to disclose, I'm the father of three kids who all attended and loved Camp Wapsie. Thank you and your dedicated staff for the wonderful experience for them. I'm sure there are plenty of parents who are saying the same thing.
Yes, we've had a lot of people that have got to experience Wapsie over the summers and watch their kids grow up at camp, and we're glad that your kids were amongst them, and we have a lot more that have, and we'll get to experience all the wonderful things that happen at camp.
I wonder if for the 100th anniversary you had any idea of how many kids have been to Camp Wapsie since 1918.
I can't say that we've actually put those numbers to paper. You know, there's a lot of history that was lost over the years due to lack of early record keeping in an office fire back in the 80s that lost a lot of records. But recently, we've been serving around 1,900 campers a summer. The first year, they started with 14, and it's grown, and it's served a lot of people over the years ever since then. So it's an awful lot of kids and older kids and adults that have participated in camp programs throughout the years.
Tell us how this camp was founded and who founded it back in 1918.
Sure. Back in 1918, Charles Philippi was an employee at the Y and decided they were going to want to do something cool, unique. So they did a canoe trip and took a bunch of kids camping. I believe it was between 14 and 22 kids in that first trip. And they went and, you know, the Y was based as a religious organization, and they did some religious studies and a lot of deep personal thoughts and connections with the kids as they did this trip. And it went over very well, and a lot of the kids stayed involved. And, you know, after that, they decided we need to do something more permanent to serve kids. So they rented some property near Central City and started Camp Wapsie and ran that for a good number of years up until about 1952. And when they found the lease was going to be up, they started exploring for a new permanent location. It took a while, but they were really happy and fortunate to find the site that we are currently on and have been serving kids here since 1953.
Mm-hmm. What's the value of camp? Well, for the parents, we know it's a welcome bit of downtime often with a few less kids running around the house. But for the kids, how would you boil that down to the value of it?
Sure, yeah. We like to joke that it's kind of a double vacation. The kids get to go to camp and have a lot of fun and learning opportunities, and then the parents have a nice little break. You know, family time is wonderful, but everybody needs a little personal time. But really, for the kids, when they come to camp, they get to come and be kids. You know, we have all sorts of wonderful activities that help kids experience the outdoors, teaching them and letting them experience nature and the natural environment. The kids come together from all walks of life when they get to camp. And they say it doesn't matter if, you know, what your parents do for a living or what your background is. A couple hours after you arrive at camp, you get dirty and kids are just kids and they get to meet new people, make friends, learn to deal with different life situations. You know, when you bring a diverse group of kids together, there's difference of opinions and different backgrounds, and kids learn problem solving and how to work together. Sometimes kids share a room with a sibling. Sometimes they have their own, but then they come to camp and they're in a cabin with two counselors and, you know, a total of 12 kids. So they learn a lot of great life skills and social skills, and especially in today's society where people are plugged in so often to social media or their phones or computers. And when they get to camp, those things don't, the kids don't have access to those.
Right, right. I wanted to ask about that because that's a big difference between now and the past. Do they have to just turn them off and turn them in, lock them up for the week that they're at Camp Wopsy?
We ask the parents and we tell the kids in advance to just leave that stuff at home. If there's an emergency, we do have phones in the office. We can communicate with families. But we really want the kids to engage in conversations with each other and learn about the outdoors. Very few kids bring them to camp. And if they do, we just ask them to turn them in and we'll hold on to them and give them at the end of the week. And everybody, I should say a lot of the kids, may be a little nervous at first, but it doesn't take long. You get so engaged and you learn how to really engage in those conversations and make friends with the people that you're living with or hanging out with at camp. And it seems a lot of the kids really forget about those phones until 15 minutes after mom and dad come and they say hi and get their hugs after a good week, and then they ask for their phone so they can go talk to all their friends and tell them about their week at camp.
Right. Now, I understand you didn't go to Camp Wopsy as a boy.
I did not. I grew up out of state and attended some other camps, but ended up finding my way here when an opportunity presented itself and fell in love with this place and got to meet a lot of the people that grew up here and I've been proud to be a part of Camp Wopsy for the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm. I understand you have an event coming up Saturday, tomorrow. What is it?
We do. We are having a big community celebration for our centennial year from 1 until 7. We're going to have an open house with a lot of the camp activities. We've got some tours so people can see what we offer at camp. And for those that have been here in the past, we're going to show and highlight a lot of the improvements that we've made over the years. And then later in the afternoon, in addition to the activities and tours, we've got a history display. We're going to do a little history program followed by a camp cookout, and then we're going to do a traditional campfire so that everybody can get that taste of camp. And this is all to highlight 100 years, and we have a big alumni reunion going on this weekend that's overlapping. So I know that we've got a couple hundred people coming from all over, from people that were here at camp last year, going to be coming this summer, and we've got some alumni that were here back in the 50s and beyond.
Right, right. So how do people find out more information on the Internet? Because I'm near Coggin. It's not the easiest place to find sometimes.
Yeah, it's not too bad, but if you just go to camplopsy.org, there's information about our centennial on our website. They can learn more. They can always call us at 435-2577, and that's a 319 area code. But we'd be happy to tell you about it. And if you just head north on 13, north of Cedar Rapids, there's highway signs that kind of point people toward camp.
All right.
1 to 7 will be a fun afternoon to enjoy camp and connect with a lot of other people that have been here over the years.
Paul Danowski, Executive Director of Camp Wopsy, celebrating this year 100 years. Paul, thanks. Good camping to you this summer.
Thank you very much. We're looking forward to it.
All that's left on this News Buzz edition of River to River is to welcome Mark Simmet, to IPR Studio One Tracks host, to groove us on into the weekend. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ben.
So what do you got for us?
We have the British band Arctic Monkeys for you.
All right. They've been around for a while, still cranking out the hits.
Yeah, they've been around since the right after the turn of the century, actually.
Okay, what do you have them playing now?
They have a new record. It's called Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino. It's kind of a loosely organized concept album, let's say, about human settlements on the moon. What would that really be like? Well, it would be just as crass as humanity on Earth, I guess.
All right. Let's hear a little bit of that, the Arctic Monkeys.
Advertising imaginative ways. Start your free trial today. Come on in the waters. Lovely look. Could meet someone you like. You're in the meat of your strike. It is that easy. Lunar surface on a Saturday night. Dressed up in silver and white. With colored old gray.
Arctic Monkeys, 4 out of 5. Mark, real quick, you got time for one other.
Yeah, sure. We've got Neil Young's new album with the band he's been working with lately, Promise of the Real. It's called Paradox, soundtrack of a film you can see on a very popular online streaming service right now. And this is a new version of a song he's done before called Peace Trail.
Okay, Mark Simmet, IPR Studio One Tracks host. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury. Lulu Dewey helped out today as well. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Tune in Monday. Charles Grassley, due to join us live. Email your questions, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. That's just a